This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies, in for Terry Gross.
Objection! I teach law at Greendale, so believe me, I don't know much about law, but I do know a contract violation when I see one.
That's our first guest, Joel McHale, the star of the comedy series Community, which it was just announced will be returning for a sixth season online on Yahoo's streaming service. NBC canceled the series after five seasons earlier this year. Community's famous for constantly alluding to and parodying movies and TV shows. Since 2004, McHale has hosted The Soup on the cable channel E!, on which he satirizes reality TV and celebrity news. The subject of his satire was politics and the news media when he was the featured comic at the White House Correspondents' Dinner in May. Now Joel McHale is co-starring in the film Deliver Us from Evil, a thriller with a supernatural edge. McHale plays a wisecracking, tough guy cop who's the partner of the film star, Eric Bana. Terry spoke with Joel McHale last Monday.
Joel McHale, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you for having me, Terry. This is a dream come true. I'm not kidding.
Thank you for saying that.
You have no idea the street cred that this is buying me right now in my hometown of Seattle and in Los Angeles. There are a lot of pasty white people that I know that are going to love this.
That makes me feel so good.
I'm pasty myself. So.
Me too.
They're my people.
Yes. So after parodying genres of all sorts in Community, you are now in a cop slash supernatural mystery thriller. So are there things you learned from Community parodying genres that you could use in the real thing?
That's a good question. Boy, when we're parroting all that stuff in Community, it's to elevate the different stories that we're telling. Like if we do a Claymation episode, it's to really magnify that Abed's character, Danny Pudi's character, is having a huge crisis at home. So when you're actually in the actual genre, I didn't even think about that. I was just very concerned not to screw up, I guess. But since the movie's kind of serious, I didn't really think about... I mean, I told a hell of a lot of jokes on set, so...
And in the film. You're very wisecracking in the film.
Yes. Well, I play a cop, and I think gallows humor among cops or doctors or paramedics, you have to show that side of them because, I they become so heavy, I think. And you got Eric Bana, who is actually a very funny guy. I think he's kind of seen as a very serious guy, but he's really not.
So getting back to parodying the genre and then being in the real thing, like there's a pretty famous paintball episode of Community in which you're all, it's a kind of parody of action films, and you're all running around with paintball guns. And in Deliver Us from Evil, there's like more than one scene where you're running up and down stairs with your gun pulled or, you know, entering into the door with your gun pulled. So is there like actor training school for running around with guns when you're not used to it?
Yes. There's a school outside of Portland, Oregon called How to Run on Camera and Not Look Like an Idiot. It's funny because like with Community, when we did the paintball episodes, which was homages to Die Hard, and we did a Western, and we did Star Wars, the only way to do it, from what I've seen, is to do it, is you must be as committed as if you were in those things, even though you're doing a comedy. And a lot of the things you saw me running down were padded, so it's very odd to run down padded stairs. Even though it's there for your safety, it's like running while you're drunk.
So they're padded in case you fall?
Yeah. And then I actually do tumble down the stairs in this huge knife fight scene. And I thought I was being really professional and would not needing a stuntman. And I tumbled down and bashed my arm open. And then they said, good job, Joel. That was really necessary. And now you have to do it five more times. And then my stunt double... he was very good to the point where I get thrown into a wall, and I did it myself once, and everyone kind of gave a clap and said, that looked great, Mr. Actor Guy. And then the stunt double did it, and it looked amazing. And then everyone clapped, and I said, how did you do that? And he said, oh, I got knocked out. He actually knocked himself unconscious, not on purpose, but he fell backwards and then came to about 5 seconds later. So he really sacrificed himself. On top of that, he's a Princeton grad. So I just want to say thank you, Princeton, for making such a great stunt double who will knock himself out for a movie.
So let's talk about Community. You play Jeff Winger, a lawyer who isn't allowed to practice at his law firm because they found out that he faked his college degree. He didn't really go to Columbia University. He went to he went to college in Columbia, South America. So he's back in Community College and kind of meets up with all these other misfits of different ages who are there for various reasons. So let's play a clip from the pilot. And this is a scene. You have a crush on one of the students. So you tell her that you're holding a Spanish study group and she should come. There really is no study group. But she tells others and they, you know, other people show up. And first you try to get them fighting so you'll have an excuse to leave with the girl you have a crush on. And then you figure out that's not working, so you'd better get them back to being friends and there being peace. So here's how you get peace to break out in this pilot episode of Community.
You know what makes humans different from other animals?
Feet.
No, no, no. Come on, bears have feet.
We're the only species on Earth that observes Shark Week. Sharks don't even observe Shark Week, but we do. For the same reason, I can pick up this pencil, tell you its name is Steve, and go like this.
Oh.
And part of you dies just a little bit on the inside because people can connect with anything. We can sympathize with a pencil, we can forgive a shark, and we can give Ben Affleck an Academy Award for screenwriting.
Big mistake.
People can find the good in just about anything but themselves. Look at me. It's clear to all of you that I am awesome. But I can never admit that because that would make me an ass. But what I can do is see what makes Annie awesome. She's driven. We need driven people, or the lights go out and the ice cream melts. And Pierce. We need guys like Pierce. This guy has wisdom to offer.
The Dalai Lama and I.
We should listen to him sometime. We wouldn't regret it. And Shirley. Shirley has earned our respect, not as a wife, not as a mother, but as a woman. And don't test her on that, because that thing about the jukebox was way too specific to be improvised. Yeah. And Troy. Who cares if Troy thinks he's all that? Maybe he is. Do you think astronauts go to the moon because they hate oxygen? No, they're trying to impress their high school's prom king. And Abed. Abed's a shaman. You ask him to pass the salt, he gives you a bowl of soup. Because you know what? Soup is better. Abed is better. You are all better than you think you are. You are just designed not to believe it when you hear it from yourself.
Soup?
I want you to look to the person to your left. Sorry, look at the person sitting next to you.
Look at her, okay.
Yeah. I want you to extend to that person the same compassion that you extend to sharks, pencils, and Ben Affleck. I want you to say to that person, I forgive you.
Yeah, well, I hope Ben Affleck's listening. Because I'm sure he's not. It's ironic because that came out 5 years ago before he won Best Picture, and now he's Batman. So I guess that's a bit dated now. Ben, I didn't write that, so I can't be responsible for the things that come out of my mouth.
There are so many pop culture references to TV shows and movies in Community. Did you always get the references, or did you need some of them explained to you?
Oh, that happened every time we would read through the scripts. We would have to look stuff up. I mean, in this last season, we made a reference to a very little-known Sean Connery movie called Zardoz, which came out.
Oh, he's running around almost like in a diaper.
Yeah, we referenced that. Uh-huh. I mean, Dan would always pack these. Like they ended up being 35-page scripts into 21 minutes. We did an entire tribute to My Dinner with Andre, where it was just my character and Abed, the brilliant Danny Pudi's character, talking at each other in a restaurant for 20 minutes on national television. There was so much dialogue.
Did you go back and watch the movie?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That movie, I mean, I couldn't believe we did it. And we had to have teleprompters because it was so much dialogue.
How did you get the part on Community?
I had just come off the Steven Soderbergh movie called The Informant with the not very talented Matt Damon. I don't know if you know that. He's not talented. But
I've never even heard of him.
Yeah, he played James Bond at some point. He's a very nice man and very talented. But I read the script and It was one of those parts that I, with the little power that I had, I pursued with all my energy and thankfully got it.
For your character of Jeff on Community, you know, most of the world is filtered through his sensibility of kind of smugness and sarcasm. Mm-hmm. Do you relate to that at all, or is that something you're
not
really,
at all, not at Terry? All. Not at all. Don't know what you were talking about. No. Yes, I mean that's a lot of people have said that character is so it's just you, right? And I go, well, I have a wife and two children. I am not a I'm not just running around and you know, I'm not a lawyer. So, but yes, I do have a very similar trait to the character in that I cheated my way through high school and college, which I love admitting, because my character lies about having an undergraduate degree. And I am pretty dyslexic, so I never could really read whatever. I did terrible on my SATs. I couldn't read the way that other students read, so I would just cheat, which in my silly brain, I was like, this is a skill that I'm developing, how to just get around everything. So in a way, that really helped inform the character.
When you say you cheated, exactly what did you do?
Oh, I was able to, I would get a hold of tests.
Really? How do you do that?
At least at that time in college, there was a way to get a hold of tests. People would have them. Different groups of students would save. I was in a fraternity for a very horrible short period of time, but it was a very organized system of saving all the tests. So you could, if it's the same teacher and they were not changing the test every year, you could be pretty close to what it was. So, and I would also just, I was terrible at doing languages. So I made sure I sat in between these two friends of mine and I made them move their desk closer to me. I mean, there's this sort of like juvenile stuff that I was doing to get through college. It was a whole different kind of performance, which was cheating. You hear that, kids? If you want your dreams to come true, just cheat.
Well, my guest has been Joel McHale. Thanks, Joel. I've lost all respect for you. The interview's over.
Oh, shoot. Dang it. I knew it. I knew this was too good to be true.
But you did go to acting school, right?
I did. Well, yes. And I didn't
cheat
through that.
You can't cheat with that. I mean,
no, because when you walk on stage, you better know your lines.
Yeah.
Memorization is a completely different thing than just reading something.
Is
it's
it,
ironic,
you know,
now.
You even tweeted, you mentioned in a recent tweet that you were dyslexic, and I wasn't sure if you were kidding or not, but apparently.
No, I'm dead serious. Not. That's why there's all these live shows we're doing with The Soup now, and I'm reading teleprompter the whole time, and people wanted to promote it by saying, anything could go wrong. That's what the E executives wanted. And I was like, no, just tell them I'm dyslexic. That should raise the stakes enough. And so I really have to concentrate. I mean, it may not look like I'm concentrating and I'm just screwing around, but I really do have to concentrate while I'm reading. And half the time I'm getting it wrong, but you can't tell because I'm just making up different words for it. So it's a kind of a smoke and mirrors. But I really am. So I didn't get diagnosed until a couple of years ago when this doctor began describing everything. I was like, oh, you're absolutely describing me right now. And they're like, yeah, we could tell.
You know, I want to talk with you about the White House Correspondents' Dinner, which you did. You were very funny. But I want to mention, you had pages with you. You had notes you were reading from. And I was thinking, I don't know if that relates to the dyslexia or not, but when I saw it, I was wondering, maybe you didn't want to put it in a teleprompter because you didn't want anybody to read it beforehand and say, you can't say that.
Right. Well, you got it. You nailed it. Yes, that's exactly it. I mean, I knew those jokes backwards and forwards by the time I got up there. I mean, I had painstakingly pored over thousands of jokes that I hired people to write. This guy named Boyd Vico and Brad Stevens and K.P. Anderson. We all did it together and wrote these jokes for months and just kept whittling it down because I wanted it to be 20 minutes long. But you don't want to put it, especially for that gig, you don't put it into a prompter because everyone wants to see your jokes. So C-SPAN wants to see your jokes so they know who to go to with their cameras. The president's people would like to see your jokes and because they want to know what you're going to talk about. And so I don't want anybody to see any of my jokes because I feel like if C-SPAN knew who I was going to make fun of, then the camera would be on them before I was finished with the joke. I mean, they knew I was going to make fun of Chris Christie. But I think it's a good policy not to show anybody your jokes. And what makes our country the greatest country in the world is that they weren't going to censor me at all. They literally put no restrictions on what I was going to say. So once I got up there, but yeah, it was I knew the jokes pretty well. And Conan O'Brien and Jimmy Kimmel said, and Seth Meyers all said, just keep telling the jokes, go slowly, and take no prisoners. And I took that advice to heart, hopefully.
And did they say, don't use a teleprompter, don't give anybody your speech beforehand?
They all said that. They all said they're going to, and everyone said they're all going to try to look at your jokes, and don't let them.
Nevertheless, C-SPAN did have you'd say CNN, Cameron was on Wolf Blitzer.
Yes. They were ready. They knew. Think they were able to anticipate some of the people I was going to hit. But, you know, I mentioned Patrick Duffy. And he was in the audience, and they didn't find
that's
him.
True.
That's
true.
Yeah. I mentioned De Niro. I made a joke about him, and I thought, well,
that was a hysterical joke. Would you do that?
Oh, what did I say? I said, and now I can't do an impression of Robert De Niro, but here's an impression of Robert De Niro's agent. And then I mimed picking up a telephone and going, he'll take it. And then I hung up. Because Robert De Niro in the past few years has, and I would too, as I believe me, if I were him, he's been cashing in on his legendary status and his national treasure status. And some of the movies he takes have not been, I mean, not every movie can be the greatest. So, but he hugged me afterwards and said, you had to do it. That's how it was good. Good. You had to do it. I would have done it too. And I went, oh, thank God. And then Chris Christie couldn't have been nicer. So I was very confused by that because I really went after him.
Well, since we're talking about Chris Christie, let's play what you said about Chris Christie just a few weeks ago at this year's White House Correspondents' Dinner.
Speaking of digestive systems, Chris Christie is here. He's actually here tonight. Wow, sir, you are a glutton for punishment. So here we go. Chris Christie, his administration canceled the train tunnel to Manhattan. They're closing the Pulaski Skyway, and they blocked the George Washington Bridge. Finally, a politician willing to stand up to America's commuters. Governor, do you want bridge jokes or size jokes? Because I got a bunch of both. I could go half and half. I know you like a combo platter. Now, I get that. I'm sorry for that joke, Governor Christie. I didn't know I was going to tell it, but I take full responsibility for it. Whoever wrote it will be fired. But the buck stops here. So I will be a man and own up to it just as soon as I get to the bottom of how it happened, because I was unaware it happened until just now. I'm appointing a blue ribbon commission of me to investigate the joke I just told. And if I find any wrongdoing on my part, I assure you, I will be dealt with. I just looked into it. It turns out I'm not responsible for it. Justice has been served. He's going to kill me.
But apparently he didn't kill you, Joel McHale.
He did not kill me, thank God. That's the first time I haven't heard that. I heard that back once, and that's the first time I've heard it back, and it's such a strange room, because if you tell a joke about one person or one party, that party is going to be silent and everyone else goes, ooh, and then you flip it to the other party and the other party also goes, ooh. So you kind of have to measure your success through oohs. Very strange. That's why at one point I think I even said, all right, now just the men. Ooh.
That's right, you did.
Sounded like they were on a roller coaster or something.
But the most strange thing about doing the White House Correspondents' Dinner, I would think this is the most strange thing, is that the president, President Obama in your case, is sitting right next to the microphone. And you know that the first thing you're going to do when what you say is finished is you're going to walk away from the podium back to your seat, and the president is going to hug, shake your hand, and either half-heartedly or enthusiastically, depending on how it went and how he took it. And you're not going to know how he took it until it's over, so that's got to be awkward. Let me play what the very, very opening was, and then we'll talk about how you got to deciding that should be the open.
Okay.
Good evening, Mr. President, or as Paul Ryan refers to you, yet another inner-city minority relying on the federal government to feed and house your family. Now, allow me to tell you a little about myself. My name is Joel McHale. I'm on an NBC show called Community. That's exactly what I thought. I also host a show called The Soup, which is on the E! Network. Thank you. To Republicans in attendance, E! Is the channel that your deeply closeted gay son likes to watch. Democrats, it's the same channel that your happy, openly gay son likes to watch.
Okay, yeah. So great opening. You made some Republican jokes, you made some Democrat jokes, you made jokes about your own show, you made jokes about your own audience. So
yes.
Covered a lot of bases really quickly. Talk a little bit about the process of getting that opening and deciding that's what the open should be. And I should say we edited that a little bit for brevity so that we could make a couple of points
right.
We wanted to get in.
Yeah. That opening, we kind of thought we have to hit the president quick and then explain who I was. That was kind of the overall.
You felt you had to explain who you were?
Yes, definitely. I still have to explain myself to my own family. So I still introduce myself to my 6 and 9-year-olds. And they go, okay, sure. All right, well, come on in. But we knew the E! Jokes would be good. And we knew the people in that audience were not the demographic of who watches Community, which is mostly teenagers. So I knew the response would be very tepid. So that's why I said that's exactly what I thought. But it's the most bizarre thing I've ever done because, yes, the president is to your right and he's 5 feet away and he has just gone up on stage and killed. He's terrific at telling jokes. So he actually does a very bizarre thing, which is warm up the audience in a very because he's up there slaying it. So you have to get up there and follow the leader of the free world. And then when you look out, into this audience, and it's the only audience I've ever been in where everyone looking back at you is somebody you know and is somebody recognizable. And it's like being in a wax museum where it's like, this is crazy. And then before the most nerve-wracking gig of your life, you sit with the First Lady for 2 hours. You have a one-on-one dinner, basically, with the First Lady, who I must add that she is possibly the loveliest person in the world next to my wife. And so you sit there and you chat, and you know in the back of your mind the whole time we are having this conversation that, oh, yes, in an hour from now, you are going to go tell jokes for 20 minutes, and if you screw this up, you will be probably dragged through the streets. So there was not one normal thing about the entire thing.
Well, Joel McHale, it's been great to have you on the show. Thank you so much for doing it.
Thank you so much for having me, and I hope I get a tote bag when I get out of here.
Yeah, only if you pledge, I think.
It better be made of hemp.
Joel McHale speaking with Terry Gross last Monday. McHale stars in the series Community, which it was just announced will be returning for a 6th season streaming on Yahoo. NBC canceled the show earlier this year. McHale also hosts The Soup on E! And co-stars in the new movie Deliver Us From Evil. Our book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review of the new novel Friendship by Emily Gould, who made a name for herself in the blogosphere. A recent profile in the New York Times Sunday Styles section described Gould as a forerunner to Lena Dunham and other confessional female bloggers, writers, and filmmakers for whom oversharing has become an art form.
The most startling thing about Emily Gould's debut literary novel is how nice it is. even its title, Friendship, is meant to be taken at face value. The novel's sincere tone takes a while to get accustomed to because of Gould's tough girl track record. She first made a name for herself in her 20s in her own Emily magazine as a bare-all confessional blogger. She also worked as a reporter and editor for the celebrity snark site Gawker. But as Gould chronicles in the semi-autobiographical novel, one's 30s are about buckling down and figuring out what's really important in life. In this case, the answer is female friendship. Men are louses, fancy college degrees may get you nowhere, careers are fickle, but girlfriends are forever. Cue the Bette Midler music. I think I feel a Hallmark moment coming on. Friendship is one of those otherwise ephemeral novels that's worth picking up, not for its somewhat sentimental message or plot, but for its color commentary. Gould's strengths as a novelist are the same strengths that distinguished her as a blogger. The sharp and often funny social observations, the inspired wordplay. Her basic tale revolves around two friends in their early 30s who've stayed too long at the singles fair that is New York City. Bev is a gentle Midwesterner who dropped out of her MFA program and is stuck working dead-end temp jobs to pay back her mounting student loan debt. She's long played sidekick to sparkling go-getter Amy. After a notorious stint reporting for a celebrity blog site that almost made her famous, Amy now works at a Jewish blog site called Yidster, and she has an artist boyfriend whose giant oil paintings of Cuisinarts have earned him ridicule on a cultural website called Fartiste. When Bev gets pregnant after a boozy hookup and Amy leaves her job and her boyfriend, the power dynamics shift and their relationship crumbles. Gould nails that 30-something moment in many a single, college-educated woman's life where she realizes she's stuck in the anticipation mode of early youth and that, sans partner, kids, and or soaring career, she doesn't have a clear sense of how to move forward. Here's how Gould describes a woman named Sally, who's a peripheral buddy to Bev and Amy, recalling her own magical thinking about growing up. Sally had assumed that staid adulthood came for everyone eventually, without exception or much effort, like a bus, if you just waited around for it long enough. Amy's version of waiting for that bus involves believing that her big career comeback is eternally just around the corner. She has so little attachment to the online writing she produces for Yidster that another character tells her she essentially has one-night stands with her work. Amy eventually quits in a huff and walks off into a stalled economy and a lesson in humility. As I said, friendship has its moments, but its simple vision of female friendship as the dependable consolation prize when nothing else in life works out feels more high school than feminist. Then again, in a summer where Katie Couric announces her marriage to financier John Molnar by tweeting, "So excited to make my debut as Mrs. John Molnar." Maybe even the mildest expression of Gen X feminist solidarity is something to cheer on rather than criticize.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Emily Gould's debut novel, Friendship. Americans eat more shrimp per capita than tuna and salmon combined. It's the most popular seafood in the U.S., and most of that shrimp comes from Asia. Most of the salmon we eat is imported, too. But while we're importing so much seafood, two-thirds of all Alaskan seafood, which includes a lot of salmon, is sent abroad. Those are examples of what our next guest, Paul Greenberg, describes as our seafood deficit. In his new book, American Catch, The Fight for Our Local Seafood, he uses shrimp and salmon as two case studies in the unraveling of America's seafood economy. And he tells the story of how oysters became the first local seafood to disappear. Greenberg is also the author of the bestseller Four Fish, The Future of the Last Wild Food. He spoke with Terry last Tuesday.
Paul Greenberg, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thanks, Terry. Great to be back.
So I want to start with a statistic that is just so mind-boggling, that 91% of the seafood Americans eat come from abroad, but one-third of the seafood Americans catch gets sold to other countries. Or to put it another way, our seafood exports more than quadrupled, but during that same period, our seafood imports doubled. And, like, boy, does that make any sense at all that we're shipping? We're sending our fish overseas and importing our fish from other countries?
Yeah, the great American fish swap. I do not think it makes sense. And in fact, what I think we're doing is we're low grading our seafood supply. In effect, what we're doing is we're sending the really great wild stuff that we harvest here on our shores abroad. And in exchange, we're importing farmed stuff that, frankly, is of an increasingly dubious nature.
Give us a sense of which fish we're exporting and which we're importing.
Well, one fish is salmon for both. We export millions of tons of wild, mostly Alaska salmon abroad, and we import mostly farmed salmon from abroad. So salmon for salmon, we're trading wild for farmed.
Give us another example.
Another great example of this fish swap is the swapping of Alaska pollock for tilapia and pangasius. Alaska pollock is the thing in the filet of fish sandwich. It's the thing in that fake crab that you find in your California roll. We use a lot of pollock ourselves, but we send 600 million pounds of it abroad every year. And in the other direction, we get a similarly kind of white flaky fish, a tilapia or a pangasius, coming to us mostly from China and Vietnam. So they fill the similar kind of fish niche, but they're very different.
Is pangasius like the catfish?
Pangasius catfish, yes. They are an air-breathing catfish from Vietnam. They originally appeared because you could put them right underneath the outhouse and they would eat the effluent.
Thank you for that.
Sorry. And then they get, but it turns out they're actually a very good fish for aquaculture in that you can cram them into a pond until they look almost like an M.C. Escher painting, like one on top of the other. I mean,
you're making
surreal.
My day.
Yeah, sorry. No, and when their ponds get too crowded and they don't have enough oxygen in them, they stick their little faces above the surfaces of the water and they breathe air. So they're kind of miraculous in one sense, and they'd be great if we could be sure that they were well inspected and so forth. But they're not. Only 2% of the seafood we import gets any kind of look from the FDA at all.
So why are we exporting so much of our fish?
Well, it's a complicated answer to that. I was just recently out in California interviewing a fisherman, and his reason was, hey, Americans just aren't hip to seafood. We only eat about 15 pounds of seafood per year per capita. That's half of the global average. The other thing is that other countries really are hip to seafood. The Chinese love seafood. The Japanese, the Koreans, they love seafood. And they're willing to pay top dollar for it. We just aren't willing to do so. We want our food cheap and easy.
And how much is like fast food fish contributing to that, whether it's like frozen fish sticks in the supermarket or fish chains like Red Lobster? Not to single out Red Lobster, but just as an example.
No.
You know, McDonald's has their fish sandwiches. All those places have their fish sandwiches now.
All of this sort of fast food commodification of seafood protein, because that's kind of what it is at this point, adds to that general preference for cheap stuff. Kind of in tandem and in league with that is the American tendency to avoid taste. I mean, you must have had like your share. Well, I'm sorry, it's true. But I mean, you must have had your share of like foodies on your show, you know, talking about flavor and texture and how Americans, the food movement and all that kind of thing. And yeah, that's true of about like 5% of Americans. But 95% of Americans really are not so into flavor. I've heard fish people talk about things like tilapia as dough delivery systems. You know, there's just a way to get a fried thing onto your plate. And so if we don't like the flavorsome fish like bluefish, like mackerel, things like oysters, things that really taste of the sea, if we don't like that, then we're going to go for these generic, homogenized, industrialized products.
I had to eat a lot of mackerel as a child. And to me, it was just a joyless fish. It was kind of bitter. It was thin. It was kind of like black in part of it. It didn't even look like a fish I thought was supposed to look.
I feel for you. Was that out of a can?
Oh, God. That would have been even worse. The vegetables were, but the fish was from a fish store, which,
really?
As you point out, they don't exist anymore. But yes, it was the neighborhood fish store.
You know, a fishmonger once said to me, guy has a bad experience of fish once, they're ruined for life. So clearly, you know, your mackerel is ruined for you. But mackerel, I actually think is a delightful fish if it's well tended to.
Delightful? Wow, okay.
Yes,
I do. In fact, in
your native Sheepshead Bay, there is a boat called the Brooklyn Six that goes out for mackerel for the 2 weeks that they're in our waters. And I love going out on the mackerel boat. I'll come back sometimes with 50 pounds of mackerel. I eat some of it super fresh, and you can have it as sushi, and it's delicious. Some of it I smoke. Some of it I pickle. Some of it I do in a weird kind of, well, it's too long to go into, but suffice it to say, I do a lot with mackerel, and I think it's a good fish. Also very high in omega-3s, maybe the highest of all the fish that we eat out there.
We should talk about salmon, because that's one of the main fish you write about in the book.
Yep.
Sockeye salmon, wild salmon from Alaska,
yep,
which we export a lot of. So,
indeed.
Salmon is such a popular fish. Why are Alaskans exporting so much wild salmon? Because wild salmon is very prized, isn't it?
Wild salmon is very prized. Part of it has to do with the history of Alaska and its proximity to Asia. Long before Americans were really, as I say, hip to seafood, Asians were. And very early trade routes developed, particularly between Japan and Alaska. But as people started opening their doors to Alaska in Asia, it wasn't just the Japanese. Now it's the Chinese. Now it's the Koreans. And so there's this sort of natural conduit. But a weird thing is that a certain amount of Alaska salmon gets caught by Americans in Alaska, sent to China, defrosted, filleted, boned, refrozen, and sent back to us. How's that for food miles?
Confusing. Why is that happening?
Mostly because we don't want to pay the labor involved in boning fish. And I think that another thing is that more and more of that fish that used to go make that round trip is actually staying in China because the Chinese are realizing how good it is, much to our detriment, I would say.
So if we buy what we think is wild Alaskan salmon, do we know if it's been frozen, shipped to China, deboned, then refrozen and sent back to the States?
We don't always know. I tend to focus on supermarkets where I kind of trust their seafood sourcing and traceability issues. And I do buy it frozen because, you know, there's only this very small window during which time wild salmon is available fresh. Right now, actually, this very month of July is the most beautiful month for fresh wild Alaska salmon. Get beyond June, July, August, and you really only should be buying frozen salmon.
So when you say you should buy frozen salmon most of the year, are you referring only to wild domestic salmon?
Yes, I'm talking only about wild salmon should you buy it frozen out of season. The reason being is that it's going to be frozen anyway. I sometimes will go to a supermarket in January and I'll see fresh wild Alaska salmon sitting out there on ice. And I just shake my head at it because I know if it's January, there's a very little chance that that fish is fresh. Nearly all of the salmon, when it comes into the processing plants in Alaska, gets immediately frozen. And that's great because if you freeze a fish right out of the water, it will be of the highest quality that you can get out of a frozen product. So when you go to the supermarket in January, don't go to the fresh seafood counter for your salmon. Go to the frozen bins and get those nice vacuum-packed Alaska salmon things. And they're just going to be of higher quality if you can defrost them carefully in your refrigerator.
Let's move on to shrimp.
Sure.
When I was growing up, shrimp was a luxury food. Like a shrimp cocktail with a few jumbo shrimp, that was a very special occasion kind of food because it was expensive. And shrimp were a delicacy. And now it's like, oh, you can eat shrimp. join us at the shrimp bar. Like, how did shrimp go from being this, like, expensive delicacy to being this, like, you know, all-you-can-eat thing?
Well, you know, I can first say that I had the same experience in my family. And, in fact, my in-laws had almost broke up their family, which is partially kosher and partially not, because the site of Thanksgiving got changed to a place that would not permit shrimp cocktail. So anyway, that's just a sign. But the breach was mended, and now shrimp cocktail is back in our lives. But the answer to the question of why shrimp is just everywhere now is very simple. It's aquaculture, and it has to do with one individual in particular, Motsugu Fujinaga, a Japanese aquaculturist who broke open the shrimp world somewhere just after World War II. He was an idealist. He had this idea that we could farm the seas and that we could feed everyone that way. And also, though, he probably was interested in making something that was profitable. There was a dish at the time in Japan called dancing shrimp, and it was made out of something called the kuruma prawn. It was a live shrimp that you dipped quickly in sake and then popped in your mouth while it was still wriggling. So obviously, for a dish like that, you need to have a good supply of live shrimp. So he figured out over the course of the 40s and the 50s how to domesticate those shrimp. And as I say, Fujinaga was an idealist. He was an internationalist. He trained many foreign students. He published his PhD dissertation in English, which in post-war Japan was kind of a heresy. And then he trained all of these international students to farm shrimp and to develop his methodologies, and they fanned out all over Asia. And now, after 40 or 50 years of this Fujinaga diaspora, we have a situation where 90% of our shrimp is coming from abroad. Half of that is farmed, and most of it is coming to us from Asia.
Is that why you say shrimp tell the story of the unraveling of the entire American seafood economy?
Yes, very much so. Shrimp were kind of like, I call it the Manchurian crustacean. They slipped in as this. So they've just now been activated. But they slipped in.
A Manchurian candidate reference.
Yes, exactly. Sorry, you know, I'm dating myself. But the shrimp slipped into our economy and opened up this conduit to Asia and to Asian aquaculture. And I should note, you know, I'm not anti-aquaculture. And China is the largest fish and seafood farmer in the world by far. But once we had those trade routes opened to China and to Southeast Asia, we started looking at other products. So, for example, this is a funny story, that Pangasius catfish I mentioned earlier. So there was a whole trade war in the United States where Americans didn't want Vietnamese Pangasius being called catfish because it was messing up our domestic catfish market. Well, then what the Chinese did is they brought over some American catfish and farmed them in China and then sold them back to us at lower the price than what we've been selling our own catfish for.
You point out an interesting focus group, and I don't know how big or significant this focus group was, but it was a focus group about fish. And people were complaining they don't like fish that tastes fishy, that they don't like how fish stinks up the kitchen when they cook it, and so they're afraid to, like, buy and cook fish and therefore rely on fish that you can just, like, it's processed to be microwavable, or it's like frozen fish, you know, that's already breaded or whatever. How significant was that focus group?
Well, I go to these conferences of intrafish, and it was industry professionals saying, this was in fact actually multiple focus groups, that whenever they try and figure out why it is Americans won't eat more seafood, the three issues that come up again and again are, I don't know what to do with it, I don't want to touch it, and I don't want it smelling up my kitchen. And I heard that across the industry from many, many different people. And I actually think that, for example, the tilapia is a direct result of that kind of research. You think about tilapia, it doesn't really taste like anything, and it doesn't really smell like anything, and you can do anything with it that you want. And now tilapia has gone from completely unknown. In fact, an aquaculturist I knew said that the first time he'd heard the word tilapia, he thought it was a stomach disease. But anyway, tilapia has gone from a completely unknown fish to being the number 4 most consumed seafood in America. And almost all of it is imported, and most of it is from China.
Well, something about tilapia. I mean, I buy tilapia because I guess I'm one of those people. I'm not a very good cook. I like, if there's a lot of splatter and I'm cooking fish, it does really like smell things up
smell
a little
of your
bit.
Kitchen.
Yeah, and you know, I'm not very good at dealing with that. And like tilapia is one of those fish, like you can't harm it. Like you can overcook it, you can do whatever you want to it, and it survives intact.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, listen, tilapia in a big global sense, tilapia is kind of a good aquaculture product in that, you know, it grows really fast. It doesn't require a lot of feed. You don't have to feed it fish. You can feed it all kinds of things. But I might say, rather than calling it fish, I'd say, like, instead of having chicken, maybe have tilapia. Not instead of having salmon, have tilapia. And the reasons are twofold. One is that, you know, it doesn't really have a connection to our local off of our coasts. But the other thing is that tilapia do not offer hardly any, I don't think they offer any omega-3 benefit at all. People assume that if they are eating fish that they're getting omega-3s, and it's just not true. Things like tilapia don't have them. Unfortunately, Terry, your mackerel is where your omegas are. So there are many great things that have omega-3s. You know, mussels turn out to have great amounts of omega-3s. Unfortunately, 90% of the mussels we eat in this country, or more than 90, are coming from abroad. But they're coming from Canada mostly and New Zealand, places that I, you know, think are pretty good with regulation. But mussels are a great, great seafood that we should be eating more of.
Well, Paul Greenberg, it's been so interesting to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Terry. It was really fun.
Paul Greenberg spoke with Terry last Tuesday. Greenberg's new book is American Catch, The Fight for Our Local Seafood. You can hear the full interview on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.